Wonder is the beginning of wisdom, so says Socrates. And as far as I can tell, there's no end to it. But if there is, I think it rolls on into the pool of one mind where everything is and love abounds. Dr. Larry Dossey has a lot of wonder. His book, One Mind, How Our Individual Mind is Part of a Greater Consciousness and Why It Matters, documents, and I may say poeticizes, the science, the philosophy, and the spirit which run equally through all of life, connecting us all. He is executive editor of Explore, the Journal of Science and Healing, and has been a driving force in reinventing medicine long before he wrote the book with that title. We just flow right into conversation, so stay tuned. I'm Robin Clare. This is Tributaries.
Oh, by the way, I love your image on your website of that contemplative surfboard. That is just great, by the way.
I know. It's just, I started going through this weird synchronicity to Kauai, and I'm addicted to surfing. So it's just been so fun getting to do that. And I feel like we figured out enough. Let's go surfing now.
Some addictions are worth having.
Exactly, yeah. Larry, to begin, in your book, you share a story about being asked a question at a talk you were giving by an elderly Indian physician, and he said, Dr. Dossey, can you be more specific about what you mean by mind and consciousness? In my tradition, they are not the same. We have many levels of consciousness and states of mind. Now, will you tell us which one you mean? And why don't you share with us what year that was and where did you go with that? Obviously, this book, I think.
Yeah, well, that's where it all wound up. This was in 1988, and I had been invited to go to New Delhi to deliver the annual Mahatma Gandhi Memorial Lecture. And I did that, and this was a peripheral meeting with a great many physicians in the New Delhi area. And it was odd because they wanted me to talk about how consciousness interacted with the body and why the mind was a potent factor in health. And I thought that this is really a kind of a crazy situation. Here we are in India, and they have for 3,000 years had a philosophy that honored this sort of thing. You know, why should somebody from the United States be over here talking about the interaction of mind and body? But I found out to my acute discomfort that they were far ahead of me in the elaborate ways they have of dissecting the terms mind and consciousness. I made a feeble attempt to answer this question. It was very feeble, and I was almost embarrassed because I realized in a heartbeat that these doctors knew far more than I did about levels and stages and states of consciousness. It was an interesting nudge to try to be more accurate about those kinds of terms, and I hope that I've learned something since then about these different levels. And really, this new book, The One Mind, is sort of a follow-up on that kind of deliberation.
Yes, and it's all part of that place where you are able to see so well into something. For instance, you know, the Upanishads, they saw so far into a consciousness and a philosophy that made so much sense. And yet within that, there you go. They start dividing into different levels of consciousness. And which one do you mean? And it starts getting very sticky because are they creating a problem or are they answering a question?
Well, that's an interesting query. You know, I find that when you start getting into a state where Indian philosophy splits up the everyday conscious into 54 different levels and then the transcendental consciousness has 40 different levels, I find that that makes a Westerner's eyes glaze over.
Me too.
Including my own. And so I have offered at the start of this book a definition of consciousness that readers can carry through if they demand a definition of consciousness. I have to say, however, that they're all pathetic because nobody has an adequate definition of consciousness from the Western perspective. And so I have relied upon a definition of consciousness from one of the great consciousness researchers, Dr. Ramakrishna Rao, who is in India. And I just consider consciousness the overarching principle that makes the mental constructs such as cognition, emotions, thoughts, feelings, awareness even. Consciousness makes all of that possible. It's the principle that sheds light on what we call mental constructs. But I don't have a definition for it, and that's not an apology, because neither does anybody else come out very forehead in that. We don't even know how adequately to define individual mind, much less what the one mind idea that I'm talking about. But we're obligated to try, Robin, because without some idea about what these things are, we are at sea in trying to understand everyday experiences in people's lives that suggest that consciousness has an unlimited extent. You can't keep it confined to the brain and the body. It apparently has no limits. So we, although we may flounder about the definitions, we can nonetheless talk about how consciousness manifests in our lives. And that's what this book tries to do.
Well, it definitely accomplishes that goal. It shows how far-reaching all of this is. Every portal into various places in our lives, there is that portal that does go into the one mind, and that's what you have done in this book. Your research is extremely far-reaching, and it's just wonderful. So we're going to take advantage of this right now and learn some things. And you just mentioned K. Ramakrishna Rao. And why is he considered one of India's eminent contemporary consciousness researchers of today?
Well, Professor Rao used to be director of research at the Rhine Research Center in Durham, North Carolina. This was the institute that was started by the famous parapsychology researcher, Dr. Rhine and his wife, and it still is going great guns. So Dr. J.B. Rhine collaborated with Dr. Rao for many, many years. What that says to me that Dr. Rao is unlike most psychological researchers in that he has an open mind to things that generally just drive contemporary psychologists crazy. When we use the word parapsychology or the paranormal, their eyes usually cross and they run in the other direction. Dr. Rao is not like that. He honors this research. He's produced quite a bit of it himself. And so he is open to human experiences that caused many psychologists simply to shut down. If you look at some of the surveys, you find that of all academics in medicine and the biological and psychological sciences, it is psychologists who have the least approval of these things that we call paranormal. They just eliminate them almost by definition in their worldview.
That's so funny. You'd think that that would be the basis of their research, to be totally open and explore that.
One would think.
Yeah.
Well, they're stuck in the brain. You know, they have bought this idea, hook, line, and sinker, that consciousness makes, that the brain makes consciousness, and consciousness is limited to the brain, and it can't manifest at a distance in the world outside the brain. This just causes them to eliminate automatically a huge body of evidence that says otherwise. There are exceptions. I know psychologists who are open to these phenomena, but they're in the minority.
Right. Well, it's I've read a story that I actually have incorporated into a script, and this little girl is very conscious, and she's talking to this doctor/scientist who is doing an autopsy on his best friend's brain, and she's looking at him, and she's she's from another country and doesn't have any intellectual training herself, and she's looking at him dig into this thing, and she said, well, what is that? And he said, well, it's my best friend's brain. And she said, well, what are you doing? He said, well, I'm doing brain research. And she said, well, what's the brain made out of? And he said, well, basically water and some compound, simple compound salts. And so she looks at him again and says, well, so do you think water and some compound salts can think and create? And so it's a good beginning from there anyway about, what is going on with all of this? And, you know, speaking of the one mind and how we meld, I really just basically took the last, 4 or 5 days to read your book. And so when I was looking over my notes today to put them in a more streamlined format so even I could read them, I started writing notes I took about individual mind is that which has become like dogma and how we think things are real because somewhere way back some people agreed upon it. But is this really real? But then writing about individual mind is that which has become like dogma, I thought, now, am I quoting something out of Larry's book or is this a thought I had when I was reading the book?
It could have been an expression of one mind.
Exactly.
You know, how if one mind is real and if there is a place where people's thoughts come together, then, as I point out in the book, it's very difficult to trace the origin of any idea or thought. And actually, this idea of the problem of origins has erupted in some of the realizations of some of the greatest creators and inventors in our culture. I quote in the book Thomas Edison's idea about the one mind, and people think he's one of the niftiest creators, inventors ever.
Definitely.
And he said that I've never created anything, which is sort of a jaw dropper right away. But then he went on to say, I get my ideas from the universe. He says, my thoughts come from the outside. So this is really a fly in the ointment, this perspective, for people who want to say that the brain generates creative thoughts and breakthroughs and all human awareness. Edison didn't believe that, and neither did a great many other giants in science in the 20th century. One of them I quote throughout the book is the Nobel physicist Erwin Schrödinger, who was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1933 for something called the Schrödinger wave equations, which lie at the heart of quantum physics. And he was emphatic. He said, we do not know consciousness in the plural. He said, we only know it in the singular. He said, mind is a singular entity. He said, I should say there is only one mind. So this is not, wandering mystic from the East who is proclaiming the unification and connectedness of all minds. And we ought to pay attention to people like that, because some of the greatest physicists and scientists of the 20th century have actually held this idea of a unified consciousness in some dimension. Another was the great physicist David Bohm, who said, deep down, all consciousness is one. So I found that I had a lot of strong, tall shoulders to stand on, Robin, when I, was researching this idea. It's really not that uncommon at all when you go poking around the thoughts and private views of some of the great scientists of the 20th century.
And those ones that did come clean, so to speak, were being honest with their experience. I mean, how many stories have we heard about the scientist just couldn't get anything together and he fell asleep and had a dream and woke up and knew exactly what he needed to do? I love the guy that made the sewing machine, even.
Elias Powell. Yeah. Well, these breakthroughs come from the unconscious. Those inventors and scientists who are most honest will have very little trouble acknowledging this. And so you wonder, where are the ideas in the meantime? You know, are they floating around in some specific spot in the brain? I don't think so, because there's just a ton of evidence that consciousness can manifest outside the brain. And people can understand something and elaborate it on it, and they have no way of knowing what they're talking about because they could not have acquired that. I talk about an episode in the life of Joseph Chilton Pierce, who many listeners will associate with his great book, The Cosmic Egg and The Crack in the Cosmic Egg. And in his latest book, Evolution's End, he relates an episode in his life when he was a young university professor. And he was obsessed, as he says, at the time, about the relationship between the Absolute or God or Goddess and human beings. And he was immersed in reading Carl Jung and was sort of stuck in his understanding. And one morning, when he was sitting in his bedroom preparing for an early morning class, his five-year-old son came in and sat down on the bed. And this little boy launched into a 20-minute discourse using complex theological terminology and reasoning and told Pierce, he says, everything there was to know about this area. He used terms that five-year-olds don't have any business knowing. And he put things together in a flat monotone in perfect sentences that Pierce says were publishable. And then his little boy's ride to kindergarten arrived, and the horn honked, and the kid got up and left. And Pierce sat there weeping. He said the hair rose on the back of his neck. He knew that he was in the presence of the uncanny. And he said it would be 30 years more in his life when he was immersed in meditation before he even approached the level of understanding that his five-year-old had just announced to him. Now, people have a choice. They can say, he made it up, you know, it's a lie, that never happened. Or they can try to understand what happened in an episode like that. These things aren't unusual. Savants have them all the time. That's part of how we think they operate in this world. But the problem is that there's no way that you can say that the brain was even mature enough to acquire this level of understanding. So we're obliged, I think, to try to come up with some other hypothesis that helps us understand how that stuff happens. That's what the book does.
Well, it's interesting to me to question why are so many people, is it fear? Is it fear that they just can't allow for something that is out of the what they would call ordinary? I mean, I feel like we should warn people if they're going to read your book, phenomena is going to have a new definition.
Well, I think that's right. I think it's a lot of things. I think fear is one of the issues. I think a lot of neuroscientists clearly see if they give an inch on any of these examples, the game changes for them. And it's very difficult for people who have invested a career in, say, the idea that consciousness is produced by the brain to suddenly, you know, in their mature years, when they're tenured and so on, to go in a direction and admit evidence that totally upstages what they have proclaimed all of their professional lives. I think this is tough for scholars and academics to do. And so they dig in their heels and pursue a sort of scorched earth policy toward these things because they can't afford to admit any of them because this would really upset their worldview.
Yes.
And so we get into this standoff where, you know, people on both sides sort of get their backs up and think the other side is about half bigoted and prejudiced and sometimes crazy for even talking in these ways. I'm at a stage in my life where I can't be fired from anything. I mean, I don't have a lot to lose here, and I just enjoy putting evidence forward, which I think can expand our idea of who we are as human beings and how we operate in this very strange world.
Of course, I mean, it can only do that, and that's sort of a premise I hold with tributaries. Obviously, every single person is not going to be interested in every single show, but if I think for me in my life, if I can hear something that, you know, will force me to question or will just take me a little bit further out from what my normal thinking is, then the next time I approach a subject matter that I am interested in, somehow it's going to stretch me. It's going to allow for that awareness to take that leap.
Well, that's what your show is all about and what makes it special. I think you've come up with the perfect name for your show. I think Tributaries Express is what we're trying to do here, which is to try to find the headwaters of wisdom that lie upstream from the main course. And you've done that for so many years, Robin, and done it beautifully.
Thank you. And tribute is in there, by the way, just in case. And I always feel like I'm paying tribute to my guests because...
Sweet.
Bravo. But to get out of the pathological disbeliefs of maybe that the one mind doesn't even exist, you talk about the existential shift that can occur. And I'm wondering if you would talk a little bit about that.
Yes, well, nothing is as effective in opening up one's mind to the nature of consciousness as than having one of these one-mind type experiences. But some of them are so extreme that they really do turn people's lives upside down and inside out and transform the way they see the world. One of the great examples currently is a book that has been written by Dr. Eben Alexander III, M.D., who is a Harvard-trained neurosurgeon who had a near-death experience. He was a skeptic, a total materialistically oriented skeptic who thought that the brain was where all the action is and consciousness is made by the brain and confined to it. Mm-hmm. Well, he had a rare disease which almost killed him. He was in coma for 5 days. The family had been called in to pull the plug, but before they could do that, he woke up and he came back with a classic near-death type of experience in which he saw the light and friends and relatives, and all of this was marinated in a sense of complete compassion and love and okayness. He resolved after recovery that he would spend the rest of his life trying to enlarge the view of consciousness, which had become real to him and which defied all of his training. And so he is one of the great examples currently in the culture of someone who had a personal collision with this idea of the one mind. For him, it became real. It was no longer philosophical. There was no room for debate for him in terms of experience. It's interesting to notice the backlash from academics toward him, because this is also part of what we see time and again. He has been attacked mercilessly by people who just can't afford to give any credence to anything he experienced. And so this is just what we see. Sometimes people like Dr. Alexander feel like they're preaching to the choir, but occasionally there are converts. There are people who come around and see that the current idea about the relationship between consciousness and the brain is really bankrupt. One of my favorite cognitive psychologists is Donald Hoffman at UC Irvine, who says the scientific study of consciousness is in the embarrassing position of having no scientific theory of consciousness. That's where we are, and that's the honest assessment of the logical and experimental value of this assumption that we've all been hypnotized by growing up in this culture, that it's all in the brain. Well, it isn't all in the brain, and that's what I've tried to describe in this book.
Well, once again, you do, and as this book goes round more and more, there are a lot of barriers that are just going to be flooded, and they're just going to fall by the wayside, literally. It's just... to me, it's almost comical hearing some of the things you say. It's like, well, how is that possible? How can the psychologists who you know, work with people every day who come in with the most amazing stories of what goes on in their head, not be willing to go to these other places. And, you know, it made me laugh out loud when there really isn't literally a bigger example of pathological disbelief when you were telling the story about the 18th century scientists who, you know, knew there was no such thing as a meteorite falling to the earth. Just wasn't possible.
Right. In spite of the fact that they could hold them in their hands. And, you know, there was one that fell in the year 1492 in Western Europe. And it weighed something like 300 pounds. And today it's in a city hall and in a little town in northeastern France, as I recall. And the reason that they didn't throw it out is because they just simply couldn't lift it. You're right. Some of this stuff does get really comical. But it also has a tragic side to it also, because it totally reduces our idea of what we're capable of as human beings. And I think this is a great tragedy. I'll just give you one example. If consciousness, as I maintain, is non-local, that is to say it's infinite in space and time, if something is infinite in time, it's immortal. It's eternal. So by denying this evidence, we really eliminate a tremendous body of evidence pointing toward human immortality in some sense. I think this is absolutely tragic. I quote people in the book who said that, such as George Orwell, who proclaimed that the failure of the belief in immortality is the greatest tragedy of modern age. And Jung qualified to be in that category also. He was a strong proponent in his patience of supporting the belief in personal immortality. And so to the extent that we deny these one-mind-type experiences, we really set the stage for a lot of unnecessary suffering for people, many of whom are scared to death that when they die, when the body dies, they will be totally annihilated and nothing of their mind or consciousness will survive. These examples I give in the book and these experiments I go into offer meaning and hope that can be the cure for that horrible level of suffering and torment for so many people.
We'll conclude our discussion of Dr. Larry Dossey's latest book, One Mind, next week. I think I would call this book a true humanitarian's autobiography into One Mind. But I'm an obvious fan. For any guest information, to listen to archives, to share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And for podcasting on iTunes, it's Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.